They're going to stay with me. Just in case they have an answer.
Okay, thank you guys so much.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah,
thank
if you've got a question, please pass them down, and a volunteer will come by and pick them up. And, Sarah has a question for me already. Okay. All right. How do you situate your work in relation to the debate surrounding linearity and non-linearity? Do you rebel against the tyranny of the line? I ask this especially because of the repetition of chapter one and because of your work in digital literature.
Huh. I don't rebel against linearity in a few ways. I really believe in the book should be read front to back. That's linearity. Within a piece, I think, complicate the ways the story threads work together, but even so, it's not meant to be random. Therefore, I wouldn't want you to read it haphazardly. So I think in some ways, I do believe in the flow of time and the flow of reading. And I use those, I think, to manipulate the stories. It's not rebelling against certain kinds of linearity. I think I'm playing with the way that you can work against the flow of time, but still be within it.
Awesome.
Does that make any
Thank
sense?
You. Yes. Okay. How do you think your writing translates to readings like this? Mm. Why use collaborators?
Yes. Well, yeah. At first I tried to use videos and other things. The pieces are very polyvocal to me. I mean, this one has a six-person protagonist, for example. So how to manifest that. If I read it all, I think it would just sound flattened. So to me, to hear the different voices brings alive the fact that there are six birds telling the story. So that's a simple one.
Okay, I have a kind of boneheaded question. It's such an amazing piece and includes so much like history, biography, autobiography, ecology, environmentalism, fiction, animal needs, animal talents, and I just want to know kind of where it started for you. What was your...
Now people are going to laugh at me because I've told this story in a class I visited today. This piece is actually a play that I wrote when I was in college. It was probably the year the poor dusky sparrow went extinct. And I was really intrigued by what that would feel like to be six men with no... what that felt like. So that was where it started, way, way, way back when. The play is unreadable now. I mean, but those six birds, well, actually there's five. The five birds were really just stuck in my head just to feel that feeling. And then it thought, well, what's different than the rest? I mean, we're all kind of, except the dip, what is the difference between dying and really dying, like extinct dying? Anyway, I was just fascinated by these poor last birds.
Who do you write for? Who's your ideal reader?
My own perfectionist self. if I can stand behind it, then I feel like it's okay. And then if others don't like it, that's totally cool.
This question is, how do you hold a book together? Maybe when do you feel it's together?
It takes a while. That's a complicated question. The book can get bloated, and then there's pieces that are too much, and then those have to come out. The book has to function as a whole. The whole discussion of all of the parts of the book have to work. So that's actually a long process. Once I decide that a certain set is going to become a book, then really being ruthless about what's going in, why, order, that kind of thing.
Okay.
In my poetry show.
Two more questions.
Okay.
In my poetry class, you described your writing style as the only way you can write. Even though your writing style is unique, are there any writers who have influenced it? If yes, who are they?
I think there's writers who gave me permissions. And that's really important. And I'm sure all of you know that the thing you really got to look for in life are the permissions to do what you want to do. certainly there's historical people whose work felt really like risky. I mentioned earlier, like, well, Virginia Woolf's book, Three Guineas, had a really profound influence on me when I read it. I just thought, wow, she went somewhere I couldn't imagine. And in a way, it was so inspiring how she went there. I've mentioned this too, but like Bouvard and Pécuchet, a very little known work of Flaubert's, which I think is just one of the best books ever written. Anne Carson of a contemporary mode. When I was very young, she was really important to me. She was one of the first people someone like handed me and said, you should read this. A lot of playwrights have been important to me because that's where I kind of started, was in theater. You know, I think it's a personal thing. I mean, I can say some things, but they wouldn't necessarily. Sometimes I say, like, oh, I love Milan Kundera, because I really do love Milan Kundera. And then some people, oh, really? I can't see that in your work. And it's kind of like, it's not really about seeing the thing. It's really about what gives you the permission. And he was an early person who gave me the permission to talk about things at the same, like, rupture my own narrative surface with thinking. And that kind of ability to think through text, it was just a matter of probably luck. It happened that I read him when I did. But the rupturing of thought into the kind of authorial surface was something he permitted me to do, I guess.
Okay, and the last question is for Mike, Aaron, and Kendra. How did speaking the voice of encyclopedic erudite birds change your day?
I speak this way naturally.
Well, we did rehearse yesterday, and what was going to be scheduled as a rehearsal was more of a like
chatting.
Can you handle these big words? Which wasn't what she asked us. It wasn't like patronizing like that. It was more like an internal question that I had asked. But it was what was interesting is that there was no there was going to be a rehearsal for this.
I know.
There was a potential third piece that we were going to read in place of one of these that would have required a lot of rehearsal. And so the fact, personally, I didn't want, except for like the really big, sometimes Latin words or like cliche, didn't look over too much because it was just, I don't want to sound too mystical because it's not that mystical, but like inhabiting a consciousness on the page. And again, that sounds way too spiritual or whatever, but it was more like, okay, let's see what happens as this happens, and we'd all encountered the work before in Anders' class, and so it was kind of our second reading was very high stakes.
I think I told you not to have poetry voice.
Yes, which sounds like always start by saying that this is not a ghost story.
Yeah, I said they couldn't have poetry voice. That was the one thing.
If I could change bodies with a really erudite sparrow, I would right now. Though probably not a dusky seaside sparrow, since there aren't any others, probably a white-crowned sparrow.
I mean, unless you wanted to be extinct, in which case it would be a perfect fit. Yeah, I mean, I think that having the opportunity to speak through this other voice is a really important thing for all of us as writers and readers. You know, it's a great opportunity to inhabit someone else's mind, and that's what reading allows us to do, and that's what having poetry readings like this allows us to do as listeners. So, yeah, I mean, it's just a fantastic thing. It's fun, not at all nerve-wracking.
You guys did a great job.
Thank you guys, all of you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everyone, for being a part of a hybrid writing mini-series. Please stick around, buy some books, and say hi to Talia. And see you next week.